she says. It's bleeding again. But I don't even remember getting hit. I look back toward the street, and Rum is wandering across the bridge that I know will take him home.
Libby. We've got 15 minutes left of lunch, and Jack Maslin drops onto the bleachers, lip bleeding onto his shirt. As he stares off into the tree line, I'm watching him, trying to put myself in his skin again. I think about going home and what it would be like if my dad walked in and I couldn't recognize him. Or if my mom miraculously came back from the dead and I didn't know it was her. If I'm putting myself in the skin of Jack Maslin, I'm feeling pretty lonely. And maybe scared. How would I know who to trust? I sit down beside him and say, "It's Libby again," even though I probably don't need to because it's pretty obvious in this group, even to someone with face blindness. He's staring out at the street like he's itching for another fight. The blood is dripping down his chin and onto his shirt, and he's not doing anything to wipe it away. I hand him a napkin. "No thanks." "Take it. You don't want Sweeney to see." He swipes at his chin with the napkin, winces a little, and then holds his soda can against it like an ice pack. He cocks an eye at me.
"Was that about me?"
"What?"
"Flabby Stout. Did I do that? With the rodeo? I want to know exactly how shitty I should feel right now."
"That wasn't about you. That was about Moses Hunt being Moses Hunt. The exact same Moses Hunt he was in fifth grade."
"Moses Hunt. Great."
The Hunt brothers are as notorious as the James Gang. There are at least five of them, maybe more, because their parents just breed and breed. Age-wise, Moses falls somewhere toward the bottom, although he looks 40 thanks to all the hard living, the missing teeth, and the fact that he's so mean. Jack says,
"Are you okay?"
"We just have history. Part of me wishes I'd let you kill him, but otherwise, yes. I'm okay." Rattled, but okay. Heart pounding, chest clenching, but okay. "Thanks for standing up for me." Jack shakes his head and stares off toward the street again. We sit there a minute, Jack watching the street, me watching him. Finally, I say, "If you're not careful, you're going to run into someone angrier than you."
"I doubt that person exists."
And this isn't charming Jack Maslin. This is a boy who is burdened by life. I make myself sit there, inside his skin. I do it for Atticus, and for my mom. "If you're not careful, you'll eat too much and get stuck in your house. Trust me. You think no one understands and you're alone, and that makes you angrier, and why don't they see it? Why doesn't someone say, 'Hey, you seem burdened by the world. Let me take that burden for a while so you don't have to carry it around all the time.' But it's on you to speak up." And then I shout, "Speak up if you've got something to say." The other delinquents turn and stare at me, and I wave.
"You're a very wise woman."
"I am, actually. You'd be amazed. But I've had a lot of time to read and watch talk shows and think. A lot. So much time to think. Sometimes all I did all day was just wander around in my mind."
"So what makes you angry?"
"Stupid people. Fake people. Mean people. My thighs. You. Death. Gym class. I worry about dying all the time, like, all the time." He shifts the can so he can see me better. "My mom died when I was 10. She got up that morning like it was any other morning, and I went to school, and my dad went to work, and I only told her I loved her because she said it first. She drove herself to the hospital. She was feeling dizzy. By the time she got there, she wasn't feeling dizzy anymore, but the doctors ordered some tests anyway." He sets the soda can down but doesn't say a word. One minute she was talking to them, and the next minute she wasn't. It all happened in an instant. "Conscious?" I snap my fingers. "Unconscious." The doctor said the thing that caused it was a cerebral hemorrhage in the right hemisphere of her brain. Something just burst.
Like an aneurysm?
Kind of. I was pulled out of assembly and my dad came to get me. We went to the hospital so I could say goodbye. My dad had to tell them to turn off the machines, and half an hour later, she died. One of the nurses said to me, "It can run in families." So I was convinced it was going to happen to me. It still might. I check in with my heart rate. Yes, it seems okay. I went to bed that night thinking, last night she was here, this morning she was here, now she's gone, and not for a few days, but forever. How can something so final happen in an instant? No preparation, no warning, no chance to do all the things you plan to do, no chance to say goodbye. His eyebrows are drawn together in a V, and he's looking at me like he can see straight into my heart and soul. Now you're the only one who knows something about me. I'm sorry about your mom. I'm sorry, too. I stare at my lunch and realize I'm not hungry. In olden times, I would have eaten every last bite because it was in front of me. I think that makes us even.
Does it?
You're not punching me, if that's what you're thinking. He laughs. It's not. In a minute, he goes, "What do your shoes say?" I hold my leg out to show him. Just quotes I like from books. He points at the most recent one, written in purple marker, the one that says, "More weight."
Where have I heard that?
Giles Corey, from The Crucible. He was the last person put to death in the Salem witch trials. Those were his final words, a kind of FU to the people who were pressing him to death with stones. Mr. Sweeney appears and yells for us to get back inside. As we're collecting our trash and walking toward the doors, Jack goes, "Moses and who else?" "The ones bullying Johnny Rumsford?" He nods. "His brother Malcolm and also Reed Young."
"Malcolm?"
Now I nod.
Shit, he's the meanest of them all.
I think the other two must be seniors.
Thanks.
He shoves his hands in his pockets. You're welcome. The light catches his wild, wild hair and holds it. And wham! Suddenly, just like that, I'm completely conscious of his guyness next to me. His long legs, the way he walks, fluid, easy, like he's made to walk through water. But at the same time with purpose, which makes him seem taller than he is, there aren't a lot of guys my age who walk like this, with swagger. It's as if I've suddenly discovered he's male. My face is hot and my back is damp and I'm thinking about Pauline Potter sexing off all that weight, and I'm staring at his hands and I'm like, "Stop staring at his hands! What are you doing? He's the enemy!" Well, maybe not the enemy, but you are absolutely not going to think of him like that. I realize he's talking, and so I come zinging back to attention. He's saying,
"I want you, Libby Strout. I've always wanted you. It's the reason I grabbed you."
Or maybe he's actually saying, "You can't tell, but I'm smiling on the inside." I say, "I'm smiling back." I try to keep my face a blank, even though I don't have a split lip. But I can't help it. For some reason, I smile so everyone can see.
Jack. It's midnight when I walk Caroline to her door. On the step, I grab her by her waist and pull her in. And her body is rigid, like she's made of broom handles and marble. I want to ask her what it is that makes her like this, all uptight and controlling and mean. I wonder where geeky Caroline is right now. If the other day was real or a fluke, and this newer, shinier Caroline has really swallowed her whole. Is there anyone in there? I want to say. Instead, I pull her in tighter and wrap both arms around her and try to squeeze geeky, awkward, nice Caroline out of there.
"Ow!"
she says.
"You always do that too hard."
She pushes me off her. People might like her more if she didn't have such a chip on her shoulder.
Who?
Libby Strout.
She has been talking about Libby all night. At dinner, during the movie, on the ride home. I laugh because, coming from Caroline, this is hilarious.
Why is that funny?
It's not. But you know. Pot. Kettle.
No, I don't know.
She crosses her arms.
Tell me more.
Smooth it over. Tell her what she wants to hear. But I don't, because suddenly I can't do it anymore. She's exhausting, and I'm exhausting, and we're exhausting. I've been telling her what she wants to hear for the past 4 years. I say, you know what? I'll talk to you later.
If you walk away, Jack, don't come back. You don't get to do that and come back.
Thanks. Got it. I feel this weird nervous energy. Like I'm doing something big and life-altering. I tell myself, you need her, as I get back into the Land Rover and drive away. I head straight to the scrapyard, where I jump the fence and wander through. And no one bothers me because it's late and dark, and I'm the only one here. It's amazing what you can find. Old license plates, old screws, a metal bumper. For me, the greatest item of all is gears. Whether they're small or big, it doesn't matter. Gears are like the power source for almost all machines, the thing that decides their force and speed. I dig for a while, and it's peaceful. Like I'm the only living soul for miles. But my mind's not in it. My heart's not in it. Too much of my life feels like this already. Trying to recycle something old into something new and better. Disguising someone else's trash as some fresh, shiny thing. In the driveway of my house, I pull out my phone. 13 texts and one voicemail from Caroline, sent over the past hour. A text from Cam. Another from Seth. I open my email and wait for it to load. I'm thinking about Libby Strout when I see it. The email. Delivered at 6:35 p.m. A reply from Brad Duchesne of the Prosopagnosia Research Centers at Dartmouth.
Monday. Libby. Before first period, Heather Alpern and the damsels are running drills on the football field. I stand on the sidelines and watch them, and I can't move because there they are. I'm starstruck. The damsels are 65 years old this year. They were originally created by two students who loved to dance, and the first ever team was made up of 20 girls. They wore skirts to their knees, which some people found shocking, and white gloves, and they performed with pom-poms and flags. Now there are 40 members, 39 without Terry Collins. At the end of the school year, everyone in Amos will turn out for the damsels' showcase, which is held in Civic Auditorium, the town's performing arts center. And I want to be on that stage. I'm in a good mood until third period. After all, I have faced Moses Hunt without the sky falling. I've made up my mind to be a damsel, and I've walked around in Jack Maslin's skin and been, yes, the bigger person. I'm practically whistling as I go to my locker. Iris follows me, wanting to know why I'm so happy. And then I open the door. The letters fall out like confetti. They are everywhere, across the hallway like a carpet. People are trampling them as they pass, and I'm on my knees trying to collect them before anyone can see them and connect them with me. Iris bends over, helping me. She opens one up and reads, "You aren't wanted." She opens another. "You aren't wanted." I grab the letters from her so she won't stand there reading every single one. There must be 100 of them. "Are these for you?" "That's my guess, Nancy Drew." Who would do this? But I know it's rhetorical because Iris Engelbrecht, more than anyone else, knows what people are capable of. When I don't answer, she says in her matter-of-fact Eeyore voice, "You need to tell someone. Take them to the principal. Come on. I'll go with you. Let's go right now. They can write us a pass for next period. I'm stuffing the letters into my backpack. I'm not going to the principal with this. And I sound as hurt, angry, and upset as I feel. Weren't you the one who told me to be brave? I never told you to be brave. You told me if I didn't speak up, Dave Kaminsky would think he could go on doing things like that to me. This is different. No, it's not. You have to let them see they can't do this to you. Let's go. I can feel the fluttering in my heart start to steady itself. This is another effect Iris has on a person. She's the human equivalent of Valium. I slam the locker door closed, shoulder my backpack, and start walking, the weight of all those letters drilling me into the ground. Iris trudges along behind me, still talking. Okay, I get it. I guess you can look on the bright side instead. It won't last forever. Eventually they'll find someone else to focus on, and then this whole fat girl rodeo thing will be forgotten. As if on cue, a group of boys goes by hollering in my direction, things like, "Saddle up, fellas! Who wants a turn?" "Bastards!" This is from Iris, because instead of speaking, I'm doing the thing I used to do when I was younger, trying to will myself small, as if by concentrating really, really hard, I might start shrinking until I'm the same size as everyone else. An acceptable size, whatever that is. One that won't make all other people feel so uncomfortable. Iris bumps my arm with hers as if she's trying to remind me she's there and I'm not alone, but for some reason it ticks me off. I never volunteered to be her savior and protector. I can't even protect myself. She starts singing the Cowardly Lion's "If I Only Had the Nerve" verse from The Wizard of Oz, and as irritating as it is, I have to admit she's got a really pretty singing voice. Bump. 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 I stop walking. Why do you want to be my friend, anyway? I talk right over her singing. Is it because I stood up for you that day? Is it because I make you feel less freakish by comparison? Or is it because when you're with me, everyone leaves you alone for once and focuses on me? Her eyes go wide, and then narrow, and Iris Engelbrecht is staring at me like she thinks I'm a bastard, too. It's because when you're not being a jerk, like this, I like you. Because except for that jerkiness, you're who I want to be. And she walks away.
Beggars can't be choosers,
Kendra Wu crows as she strolls by with Caroline Luchamp. I stand there, my hand on the classroom door, and yell, "What's that supposed to mean?" They're still heading away from me, but Caroline turns to face me, as graceful walking backward as she is walking the regular way.
What she's trying to say is that you might not want to burn your bridges when you're standing on an island.
And then she smiles the meanest smile I've ever seen. In driver's ed, Mr. Dominguez says,
"Libby, whenever you want to join us."
"Sorry." I stop staring into space. Bailey passes me a note.
"Are you okay?"
Instead of answering, I sit there and pretend I'm paying attention. And even when Mr. Dominguez says,
"Next week, we're ready to start driving,"
the moment I've been waiting for all my short, sad life, it's like I'm sitting in another room, at another school, far, far away.
Jack. I'm in the bathroom after third period when two guys walk in. Both white, both nondescript. Except that one is a fucking mountain and the other is about my height. They shut the door. This is bad news because for as long as I've been at MVB, that door has never been closed. "What's up?" I do the head nod, act casual. But even though I can't recognize their faces, I recognize the emotion. They're mad as hell. I saunter toward the exit, trying to look as carefree as one can in this particular situation, but the smaller one blocks my way.
"When you messed around with my girlfriend, I let it go." But when you jump me and my friends for no reason and try to beat the living shit out of us, you don't do that, man. You don't screw with the people I love. This tells me it's almost definitely, probably Reed Young. And that right there behind him is definitely, probably Moses Hunt. I'm feeling reckless enough to go, "So you're saying you love him?" I nod at Moses. And they both lunge for me. I can't afford another fight, so I duck, and probably Reed goes sprawling, while probably Moses ricochets into the wall. And then I throw open the door, and I'm out of there. I don't run. Hell no. But I burn a path in the floor all the way down the hall. For as long as people have been around, we've relied on facial recognition for survival. Back in caveman times, whether a person lived or died could come down to being able to read a face. You had to know your enemy. And here I am, barely able to make it out alive from a high school bathroom.
Libby. Mr. Levine, electric blue bow tie, electric blue sneakers, is sitting on the risers waiting for us as we walk into the old gym. We take our usual seats, and after we have a chance to get settled, he bounces to his feet. "We're going to try something different," which is what he says every day. So far, we've sung songs, run a kind of obstacle course, stopping at each station to talk about a specific feeling or ways in which we might change our behaviors, and performed a scene from a Star Trek episode about two enemies having to work together to survive. Mr. Levine calls these team-building exercises. But this time, he walks out of the gym. We wait. When Mr. Levine doesn't return, Travis Kearns says, "Can we leave?" And then, the gym goes dark, the only light coming from these narrow windows way up by the ceiling. A second later, the room starts spinning with these spiraling globes of light, pink, orange, green, yellow, blue. It's what I imagine a European disco was like back in the 1970s. What the? But Travis doesn't finish because a song booms out over the speaker system so loud I almost cover my ears. It's the sappiest 80s ballad you've ever heard, and all that's missing is a DJ and a corsage pinned to my shirt. Mr. Levine comes back in and says, "On your feet!" He waves his hands like he's some sort of conductor and we're his orchestra. "Up! Up, time's a-wasting. Let's work on building that self-esteem." One by one, we stand. Kashan and Natasha kind of jokingly start slow dancing. When they stop, Mr. Levine says, "Keep going." "Yes, it's really that simple. Now the rest of you." Travis Kearns asks Maddie, who's pretty but shy. She stares at her feet the whole time. Even though there aren't enough girls to go around, no one asks me. Andy Thornburg starts waltzing with an invisible partner because dancing alone is apparently better than dancing with me. My chest flutters, the first sign of panic. Mr. Levine says, "Ask her to dance, Jack." "What?" "You heard me." Jack looks at me and I look at him. "Before the song ends, please." We keep standing there, and now my palms are damp, the second sign of panic. The next thing will be this strange compression in my chest and head as if I'm being squeezed by a giant boa constrictor. Gradually, everything will grow dim and distant, and I'll shrink until I'm a regular-sized person, and then keep shrinking until I'm small enough to squash under someone's shoe. Finally, Mr. Levine pulls out this remote and clicks it, and the song starts over. Everyone groans. "I can do this all day. My phone is fully charged, and there are a lot more songs just like this on there. Worse ones, even." I look at Jack, and he looks at me. And the lights are flashing across his face, turning his eyes green, brown, blue, gold, like he's a chameleon changing colors. He offers his hand. I take it. "Because we have to." This is not the way I imagined my first school dance. We fumble our hands together and stand as far apart as possible, like someone's holding a ruler, more like a yardstick, between us. We shuffle back and forth as if we're both made of wood, staring at the ceiling, the floor, the walls, the other kids, anywhere but at each other. The song only gets cheesier as it goes on, and the lights are swirling and strobing, and his eyes are flashing green, brown, blue, gold, and suddenly I'm thinking about my palms, like how sweaty they are. I can just hear Jack Maslin going back to his friends, telling them all about my sweaty palms and what it was like to dance with the fat girl. Jack says, "This may scare me off school dances forever." My first instinct is that he's talking about me, or maybe my damp hands, so I go, "Well, I'm not exactly having the time of my life." "I didn't mean you're scaring me off, although you're kind of scaring me off now." "Sorry." As I realize he means the song, and the lights, and Mr. Levine standing there like the world's most attentive chaperone. We're now kind of swaying, and it's not so bad. It's the first time we've touched where I wasn't either punching him or stopping him from punching someone. I say, "This is my first school dance." "Ah. Well, it's the closest I've ever come, at least. Not to put any pressure on you."
"No pressure. Just extreme performance anxiety. Every guy's dream."
"You're not a terrible dancer."
"My confidence is soaring now."
"It's just not exactly how I pictured it."
"Okay. So, what can I do to change that?" "You look really pretty tonight."
In the second it takes me to realize he's playing, my legs grow into the floor like roots. Jack tightens his grip on me and kind of nudges me into motion again. He says,
"Especially in that dress. The color really brings out your eyes."
Think. The sales clerk called it Hershey Brown.
Ugh, what? Actually, more like amber.
And he's looking into my eyes as if I'm the only thing he sees. I tell myself, he's such a good actor, as these little goosebumps spring out at the base of my spine and go shooting up my back, across my shoulders, and down both arms. Suddenly we're dancing closer, and I'm aware of not just his hands, but each individual finger connecting to my body and his legs bumping against mine. I want to lean in and get a whiff of him and rest my head on his shoulder, or maybe make out with his neck. Afterward, he'll walk me home and kiss me on the doorstep, sweet at first, and then hungrier and hungrier till we fall into the bushes and go rolling off across the yard. All at once, the song ends and a fast song begins, and my eyes fly open. We immediately break apart, and Jack wipes his hands on his jeans. Ech! Mr. Levine goes,
"Don't stop! It's a dance-off! Go, go, go!"
And he's dancing like a crazy man. For a moment, all we can do is gawp at him. I mean, it's a spectacle! The man is all legs and arms and flopping hair.
"The longer you don't dance, the longer we're here. I'm getting at least 3 songs out of you."
And he starts it over. Jack Maslin goes, "Shit," and then begins to move. Of course, I think. Of course he can dance. Because he's their leader, they all start dancing. First Andy, and then Keyshawn, Natasha, Travis, and even Maddie. Jack Maslin is not my leader, so I'm still standing there. Once again, Mr. Levine starts the song over.
"I'm going to keep doing that till we're all moving."
It's one thing to twirl in the near-empty park with Rachel, but it's another to start shaking and jumping on school property in front of my counselor and my fellow classmates, delinquents though they may be. In that moment, my damsel's dream wavers because the audition will be so much worse. The audition means Heather Alpern and her squad captains, including Caroline Muchamp, sitting at a table, watching me. If I'm able to get past the potential humiliation of that moment, how will I ever perform in costume for the school? But this song, it's so... I realize I'm kind of tapping my foot and bouncing my head. No, I think. Libby, you can't. But the song is...
Oh, my God. I feel my hips start to move a little. No, 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 don't do it. But I'm alive. I'm here. We never know how long we have. We're never guaranteed tomorrow. I could die right now. Right here. It could be over in an instant. She woke up like it was any other day. Just like I did. Just like Dad did. We thought it was a regular normal day. None of us knew we were waking up to the worst day. If we'd known, what would we have done? Would we have held on to her tight and tried to keep her here? The song starts over. Kishan goes, "Come on, Libby. Damn!" What would Mom want me to do right now, if she could see me? What would she say? And then, Jack Maslin is suddenly breaking out these moves. Kishan and Natasha are doing some sort of routine, and Mr. Levine is kicking his legs out like he's Heather Alpern, former Rockette. Even shy little Maddie is shaking her shoulders. Stay still. Wait out the song. Don't you do it, Libby. But I can feel my body taking over my mind, and this is what happens. The dance is in me. All at once I'm in there, waving my arms, waving my booty, swinging my hair. I jump a little, and when the gym floor doesn't collapse, I jump some more. Jack starts jumping too, and before I can stop myself, I spin off into a twirl. Jack shouts, "What's that dance called?" I say the first name I think of, "The merry-go-round." I twirl and twirl, and then Mr. Levine is twirling, and Jack is twirling, and all the others are twirling, just like the lights. Until the gym turns upside down. Heather Alpern is still in her office. She says, "Libby, isn't it?" Her voice is warm, like honey. "I heard that Terry Collins is moving, and I wondered if there was going to be an audition for the damsels." I'm still flushed and entirely electrified from the dancing. I want to climb onto her desk and make it my stage and audition right here, right now. But instead I hand her my application. "Thanks so much for this." She smiles, and I have to look away because she's just that lovely. I'll be announcing tryouts next week. Outside it's starting to rain. The parking lot is empty and my dad isn't there, so I stand up against the building where I won't get wet. Even though the last thing I ever want to do is stand against a building like I'm fifth-grade Libby Strout, banished from the playground. In a minute, this old Jeep-looking thing comes rolling up. The driver's window rolls down and Jack Maslin says, "Need a ride?" "No." "Do you want to at least wait in here?" "That's okay." But then the sky cracks in two, and water comes flooding down. I run for the car, and he throws open my door, and I climb in as gracefully as possible, which unfortunately means I'm slipping and sliding all over the place, shoes squeaking against the floor mat, hair sticking to my face. I slam the door closed, and here I am, panting, and enormous, and soaked to the skin, in the front seat of Jack Maslin's Land Rover. I'm conscious of everything dripping, my hair, my hands, my jeans. This is one of those times when I can feel myself taking up too much space. I say, "Nice car." The interior is a kind of burnt orange red, but it's all pretty basic and rugged. One thing is clear, though. I am in the vehicle of a cool guy. "It looks like something you'd take on safari."
"Thanks."
"Truck? Car? What do you call it exactly?"
"How about the baddest mofo in Amos?"
"Let's not go crazy."
Jack. I'm getting the heater going, and now the windows are fogging. She says, "I thought everyone was gone. I was driving away and saw you come out. I thought you might need a ride or at least some shelter. My dad's usually on time." She pulls out her phone and checks it, and I can see the worry in her, even though she's trying to blink it away. "He'll be here." We sit watching the rain pour down. The music is playing low and the windows are steaming. If this was Caroline, we'd be making out. And then I'm thinking about making out with Libby Strout. What the hell? I tell myself, This is the girl you saw lifted out of her house by a crane. But then I'm thinking about making out with her a little more. Stop thinking about making out with Libby Stroud. I go, let me ask you something. If there was a test you could take to find out if you have what your mom had, would you take it? She tilts her head to one side and studies the dash. After she died, my dad took me to see a neurologist. He said, I can run a battery of tests on you to see if you have any aneurysms in your brain. If you have them, there's a chance we can pin them off so they don't become problems down the line. But there's no guarantee that they'll be fixable. My dad and I went home and talked about it. I was too young to understand it all, so he was the one who made the decision. Did you do it? No. What about now? Would you do it now? I don't know. And even though we're talking about aneurysms, I'm still thinking about making out with her. So I say, Jesus, woman, you can dance. She smiles. I smile. She says, I just handed in my damsel's application. Really? She arches an eyebrow. Sorry? Is that shocking to you? Only because I can't picture you dancing in formation. I'm not getting the whole wielding flags and wearing the same costume as 30 other girls vibe. I see you as a do-your-own-thing girl. If you ask me, you're better than the damsels. Thanks. She unzips her backpack and pulls something out. And at first it looks innocent, just a crumpled-up sheet of white paper. But then I read what's written there. You aren't wanted. Where did you get this? My locker. Do you know who put it there? No. But does it matter? And I know what she means. No, it doesn't. Not really. The point is that it was sent at all. That anyone would think that or say that to her. People can be great. But they can also be lousy. I am often lousy. But not completely lousy. You, Libby Stroud, are great. I don't know about that, but this right here is one reason I'm auditioning. She takes the paper from me and waves it. They can tell me this all they want, but I'm not listening. She crumples it up and shoves it back in her bag. I say, I've got something to show you too. And then I go into my phone and pull something up and hold it out to her. She reads the email out loud. Dear Jack. And I like the way she says my name. I mean, I really like it. Thank you for reaching out. We would be very interested in testing you. If you aren't able to make it to Hanover, we suggest being in touch with Dr. Amber Klein, Department of Brain Sciences, Cognitive Neurology, Indiana University, Bloomington. Best. Brad Duchaine. She looks up. Is this about the prosopagnosia? Yeah. I wouldn't have written to him if it hadn't been for you. Are you going to do it? I don't know. Yes. Wouldn't you need your parents' permission? I'll be 18 soon. When? October 1st. She hands the phone back to me, studies the dash again, then looks at me with wide amber eyes. So, let's go. What? As soon as you turn 18, let's go to Bloomington. Really? Why not? Before I know what's happening, my eyes are reaching for her, and hers are reaching for mine. Across the seat, our eyes are holding hands. We sit like this until the sound of a horn makes us jump. I wait until they drive away before heading to Maslin's, where I'm in such a good mood that I'm civil to my dad. It stings a little to see how surprised he is by this. So I go one step further and talk to him about the robot I'm building for Dusty. It's going to be as tall as Dusty, maybe taller. It's going to talk. It's going to be the best damn robot ever. To his credit, my dad is polite and asks questions. We don't mention Monica Chapman. We don't mention the email. And for a minute I think, maybe this is where we stay. Right here, in this small radius where it's safe. Maybe we can just stay right here, safe like this. Forever. 2 hours later, when I get back in the Land Rover, it still smells like her. Sunshine.
Libby. After dinner, my dad and I watch TV with George. Dad is eating grapes one at a time, tipping his head back and throwing them into the air, catching them with his mouth as George swats at them. I lean my head back and catch one in my own mouth. I savor it the way I'm supposed to savor food that's good for me. I bite it a little, and it bursts into an eruption of goodness. I was on fire today. I lit up the old gym. You should have seen me. I'm making up for every lost moment when I couldn't move or get out of bed. The dance is in me. Just wait till they see me at the damsel's audition. I'm going to nail it. I'm going to dance my heart out for all the world to see.
The Maslin boy. Everything okay there? Is he leaving you alone?
He's not bothering me. Not in that way, at least.
Libs, you know you can talk to me about anything.
And I feel myself going bright red. What if my dad can read my thoughts? What if he can see how I am at this exact moment, undressing Jack Maslin while I eat these grapes? I know, Dad. For the first time in my life, I don't want to talk to him. Not about Jack, and not about the letters. If I do, I become something he has to worry about, and I've already been something he has to worry about for too long. I'm thinking of ditching school on October 1st. One of the things my dad made me promise after my mom died was that I would always let him know where I was, and I figure I can at least tell him this much. A friend of mine needs to go to Indiana University to take part in a research study.
Who's this friend?
Just someone from school. I don't tell him it's Jack. I figure it's enough that I'm sitting here telling my father I want to skip school. He's going through some things right now. I want to be there for him.
Do you have any tests that day? Anything big that you'd be missing?
Not that I know of.
Is it a...
date? No. I don't think so. I mean, it isn't. But it makes me wonder. Could it turn into one? No, I say again. It was my idea to go. I almost say, I'm thinking about getting tested, too. I know we talked about it after Mom died, but now that I'm older, I think I might want to. Maybe that way I won't worry as much. I throw myself a grape and miss my mouth. Or maybe I'll worry more, depending on what I find out. I pick the grape off my shirt and then frown at the shirt. Do you think we could go shopping? He raises an eyebrow.
For your non-date?
You wouldn't actually have to go. You could just let me borrow money. Or I could get a job.
No jobs. Not right now. One thing at a time.
So can I borrow some money then?
You realize you've just asked me if you can skip school and borrow money in the same conversation. You realize I'm the world's best dad?
I do. He tilts his head back, and I throw him a grape. I throw George a grape, and he smacks it across the room. I throw myself a grape. And this time, I catch it like a pro. In my room, I pick up my phone and settle back against the headboard. I call Bailey because this is what real friends who aren't imaginary do. When she answers, I say, "What do you think of Jack Maslin? As a person or as a guy?" "Both." "I think he's basically a good person who sometimes lacks judgment. As a guy, I think he's cute and funny and he knows it, but he's not as jerky as a lot of them. Why?"
"Oh, I'm just wondering."
"I'm not telling you how to feel, Libs, but he and Caroline are one of those forever couples. I mean, even when they're not together, they're together. And if it was me, I wouldn't want to go near him. You'd just set yourself up for heartbreak."
"I'm not saying I'm interested."
"But am I?" I change the subject to Terry Collins and the damsels, and Bailey tells me about this boy she likes who lives in Newcastle. We talk for a while, and afterward I go on Iris's Instagram account, where I like every single one of her most recent posts. I choose one randomly and comment on it, and I almost leave it at that. But then I decide to call her. I go straight to voicemail and leave a rambling apology. She calls me back immediately, and even though I don't want to, I answer. Because I am not an island.
Jack. At home, I find Mom with hair up in her study, deep in work. Law books open, laptop humming. I rap on the door. Oldest son, reporting for duty. She gives me a mom look. Did you manage to make it through the day without assaulting anyone or having to see the principal? Yes, I did. I raise my arms in a triumphant V, like I just crossed a finish line. Well done. Let's see if we can have more days like this. She holds up one hand, fingers crossed, while the other hand marks her place in one of the books. By the way, a package came for you. I left it on the island in the kitchen. What did you order? Just stuff for school. I'm hoping she'll take this as evidence that I'm a new and improved Jack. Lesson learned. Her phone rings, and she shakes her head. Go ahead and get pizza or something for dinner. Unless your dad can throw something together. I don't think he's home yet. Her face goes blank. And before she can say anything, and because she works hard, and he's a louse, and because she doesn't deserve to feel bad about anything, I jog around the desk and kiss her on the cheek. You're welcome to all this swag, Mom. I've got so much to spare. Here's a little more to help you with your case. And I hug her. It's not much, but it makes her laugh, even as she's pushing me away. I open the box in my room. Two titles by Oliver Sacks. A textbookish volume on visual perception called Face and Mind. And a biography of prosopagnosic painter Chuck Close, who's made a name for himself painting faces and is a total badass. He's in a wheelchair with a messed up hand, and he's face blind. But he creates these paintings that are really damn awesome. This is how he does it. He photographs the face. He maps the face by making a photographic grid of it. He then builds the face piece by piece on canvas, using oils, acrylics, ink, graphite, or colored pencils. According to him, it's always about the face. Only about the face. Because the face is a roadmap of life.
Libby. I text JV. Our conversation begins, as always, with Atticus Finch. Me. Let's say Atticus Finch is your father. JV. Am I Scout or Jem? Me. Either. Or JV. JV Finch. JV. Of the Filipino Finches. Continue. Me. Let's say there's an illness that runs in the family, and when you were little, Atticus decided you shouldn't be tested for it. JV. Atticus is usually right. Is there a cure? Me. Not really. JV. Am I questioning Atticus now that I am all grown up and womanly? Me. Maybe. JV. How old am I now? Me. Our age. JV. I'd assume old Atticus had his reasons. He's Atticus Finch, after all. 5 seconds later. JV. But there's something to be said for making your own decisions.
How to Build a Robot by Jack Maslin. 1. Collect as many Lego pieces and other materials as possible. 2. Draw up schematic of design. 3. Ignore How to Build a Lego Robot websites because this is for Dusty, and he deserves something original that has never been created before. 4. Rewatch The Day the Earth Stood Still. The original, not the remake. For procrastination designed as inspiration-gathering purposes. 5. Take everything you can find of any value from the scrapyard. 6. Order missing parts, if impossible to find at scrapyard. Microcontroller, breadboard, circuit board, battery, jumper wires, gear motors, power jack, speaker, infrared receiver, rotation servos, various brackets and hardware, motorized scroll saw, etc. 7. Create sketches that will tell the robot what to do. Basically, program its brain. When I was 6, I climbed up on the roof of the house, trying to be a superhero. I was Iron Man in my Iron Man suit. Only in reality, I was wearing a t-shirt and a pair of swim trunks, which meant that instead of flying, I dove headfirst into the earth and cracked my skull open. 67 stitches. Did I recognize people before that? I can't remember. 8. Give it a good brain. A complete, fully functioning, normal, regular brain.
1 week later.
Jack. October 1st is a Tuesday. I play sick and hide the keys to the Land Rover so Marcus can't take it to school. When a tall boy with shaggy hair comes into my room and starts yelling at me, I figure it's him. I know you've got the keys, you faker! I cough loudly. He starts digging through my shit. Bookshelves, drawers, closet. He's picking my jeans up off the floor and searching the pockets. I hack away like I've got tuberculosis until a woman appears at the door and wants to know what in the great Fanny Adams is going on. In answer, I cough myself ragged, which makes her point to the door and tell the tall-slash-shaggy boy to get the hell downstairs. Now. The woman says, "Do you need anything before we go?" "I'll be okay." I don't actually mean to, but I sound like a martyr. I cough a little more. And then she's gone, and I lie still, listening to the leaving sounds that are happening downstairs. I hear the front door slam, and I lie there another minute. I hear a car engine kick in, and then I'm up and at the window, counting the bodies down below. The woman climbs into one car with this little kid, and a man with thick, dark hair gets in another car with the tall-slash-shaggy boy. I watch them pull away and turn in opposite directions at the end of the block. First one, and then the other. Like that, I fly into motion. I'm grabbing the keys from beneath the mattress, pulling on clothes, running down the stairs, shoving a bagel in my mouth, jumping in the Land Rover, and heading across town to Libby's. Libby's neighborhood is street after street of these new houses that look identical, one after the other. There's nothing to distinguish her house from the rest of them, except for the girl who lives there. She's waiting for me on the curb, wearing this purple dress, and it reminds me of something an actual woman would wear, tucked here, loose there, fitted there. Her hair is down and lit up by the sun. I can see beauty. The more symmetrical the face, the more average the person looks to me because there's this sameness to them, even if other people think they're hot. A person has to have something unique about them. Libby's face is symmetrical, but her beauty has nothing to do with sameness. I recognize it as she swings the door open and climbs into the car. She's graceful, especially for someone so large. She kind of swoops in like Tarzan, kicks off her shoes and wiggles her toes. Her toenails are purple, too. I say, "You look great." She cocks her head at me. "Are you flirting with me, Jack Maslin?" "I'm just stating the obvious." She pulls her hair off her neck, and I want to say, "Don't do that. You'll disappear before my eyes." But then you can tell she rethinks it. Maybe she remembers that I've told her this before, and lets it fall back around her shoulders. Then she hands me something wrapped in Christmas paper and about 50 bows. "Happy birthday. If you can't tell, I like Christmas paper best." You didn't have to do anything. "I wanted to. Open it." I tear off the wrapping and the bows go flying. She picks one up and sticks it to her hair right over her left ear. She picks up another and sticks it to the knee of my jeans. I pick one up and stick it to the end of my nose, and then stick one on the end of her nose. She says from behind the bow, "Open, please." It's a book. We Have Always Lived in the Castle, by Shirley Jackson. At first, I'm thrown. I wonder if she knows. She must know I was the one who sent this to her at the hospital. I look at her, but she's got this wide, open smile on her face, and I can see that, no, she doesn't know. I flip through the book. It's not the same copy I sent her years ago, but it's still well-worn and well-read. I wasn't sure what to get you because what do you get the boy who has everything, including face blindness? So I thought I'd get you something I love. It's my favorite book. You don't have to read it, but the girl, Mary Catherine, Mary Cat, they call her, she reminds me of, me, I guess. And I don't know. I thought you might relate to her, too. I'll read it. I smile at her. Thank you. She smiles at me. You're welcome. And we're having what feels like a moment. Suddenly the air isn't just filled with bows. It's filled with some sort of electric current that links her seat to mine. She does the impossible. Slices through the current by speaking first. So, are you ready for this? As I'll ever be. At first, I'm amped. I talk her ear off, telling her about every online test I've taken. And this guy with prosopagnosia named Bill Choicer, who lives in San Francisco, and is an old bearded dude who wrote a book about face blindness, which he's posted on the internet for all to read. All about the impact being face blind has on school, work, relationships, life. But the closer we get to Bloomington, the quieter I get. I can feel the air going out of me. What am I going to find out? Will Dr. Amber Klein be able to help me? Should I be going to New Hampshire instead to see Brad Duchaine? What if this whole trip is a waste of time? What if they tell me I've got some serious illness? What if I find out it isn't face blindness, but cancer of the brain? I can almost feel you thinking right now. I look at her. Did you forget I was in the car with you? I'm so deep in the forest of my mind that, yeah, I almost did. Sorry. We pass a sign. Bloomington, 10 miles. I feel my stomach drop and land somewhere around the gas pedal. Does this thing have a radio? Does it have a radio? What do you think, woman? Christ almighty. I hit a button and music fills the Land Rover, taking up all the space around us. I try to concentrate on the words, on the melody. But then she starts searching through songs and this feels like my brain. Fragments of words, fragments of melodies, fragments of moments, fragments of things. Finally, she finds a song she likes, and then she cranks it. Disco? Are you fucking kidding me? I reach for the radio, but she smacks my hand away. I reach around her hand, and she smacks it again. And then it's not about turning off the music. It's about touching her. And our hands are flirting. Finally, she grabs my fingers and holds on to them. And that electric current is sparking out of my thumb, my pinky, and the fingers in between. I cough because what the fuck is happening? I say to the car, I'm so sorry this had to happen to you, baby. I'm sorry you ever had to hear this. I'm sorry I ever had to hear this. I'm sorry I'm still hearing it. Libby hollers, what? I can't hear you over my own singing and this amazing beat. Now she's singing as loud as she can and dancing. She lets go of my hand and yells, spontaneous dance party! And goes on singing. But now she's dancing bigger and broader, like she's on stage somewhere. I love to love, but my baby just loves to dance. He wants to dance. He loves to dance. He's got to dance. What the f- The minute the band begins to swing it, he's on his feet to dig it and dance the night away. Stop. I'm spinning like a top. We'll dance until we drop. It's pretty much the corniest song I've ever heard. But Libby is into it. She's grooving all over the seat, shaking her shoulders, shimmying toward me.